Welcome to this week's edition of the Excellence in Training Academy, where trainers come to grow at excellenceintrainingacademy.com. I'm very, very pleased to have back with us Jonathan Hack. Jonathan is a barrister and solicitor with over 30 years' experience as a Crown Prosecutor with the Alberta Crown Prosecution Service in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. As a prosecutor, he primarily prosecuted homicides and other major crimes and continues to specialize in legal issues regarding forensic video analysis and expert witness evidence in general. Jonathan has been teaching law at the post-secondary level for over 30 years. He taught criminal law as well as evidence and procedure in the Justice Studies faculty at Mount Royal University in Calgary. He also taught expert witness testimony in the Forensic Studies program at Mount Royal University. Jonathan is currently a sessional lecturer in the Dillon School of Business at the University of Lethbridge, where he's been teaching management law since 2002. Beginning in 2000, Jonathan became actively involved in researching and writing about the law in relation to the use of video evidence in criminal prosecutions and in the training of forensic video analysis analysts from the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and other countries. He also trains lawyers on the subject of forensic video analysis law. Since 2000, he's been the principal legal instructor for the Law Enforcement and Emergency Services Video Association International, where he has presented at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Academy, and various other locations in North America and the United Kingdom. In this capacity, he was an adjunct instructor at the University of Indianapolis from 2004 to 2014. Jonathan researches and writes extensively in the area of forensic video analysis and is regarded as a leader in this area of law. His teaching has recently expanded to include Singapore, Hong Kong, and Italy. Jonathan developed a dynamic and highly effective course on expert witness testimony, which is designed for expert witnesses in any field of expertise. Since 2006, this course has been presented at various locations in Canada and the United States for federal investigative agencies, forensic laboratories, provincial and state regulatory agencies, provincial, state, and municipal police services, and other professional groups. He also developed and presents a course on courtroom testimony for investigators. Jonathan received his legal education in three countries. He holds a diploma in criminal justice from Mount Royal University, a Bachelor of Science degree with distinction in criminal justice from California State University, a Bachelor of Laws degrees from the University of British Columbia, and a Master of Laws degree from Cambridge University in England. He was appointed Queen's Counsel in 2006. Jonathan is based out of Calgary, Alberta, and The Hague in the Netherlands. So, Jonathan, welcome back to the Excellence in Training Academy.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Brian.
Now, when we did the first interview, we talked about expert witness testimony, and you provided a lot of great information on the keys to that. What I want to talk about this time is this whole issue of digital video and forensic video and issues that when we attempt to or utilize video in court. And I think there's a lot of probably things that we as the average law enforcement officer or investigator don't know. And we certainly don't want to screw things up only to lose that perhaps critical piece of evidence in court. So can we start by talking about acquiring video? It seems to me that when I started my career and when you started as a prosecutor, the sources of video were probably pretty limited compared to what they are now. So can you talk about acquiring video as evidence?
Sure. And you make a good point, Brian, because when I started teaching at the FBI Academy in 2000, all we taught for several years was analog video. And when it came to analog video, that would simply involve the police going to the 7-Eleven store, whatever establishment, and being handed the original videotape from that recorder. And so acquisition of video in those cases was really easy because it was just one tape housing that the police would gather. And we could have pretty good confidence in the integrity of that media. Acquisition of video nowadays is completely different because we're dealing almost exclusively with digital video. And so that means that the video resides on a hard drive or a server. And it isn't the case of just hitting eject and having the black tape housing ejected. So what the police have to consider now is when they're acquiring video, they have to make sure that they get all of the video from all of the relevant cameras for all of the relevant time frame, and it has to be extracted or exported from the DVR or the server correctly. And what often happens by default is police officers will go to a 7-Eleven store and the clerk will say, here's the video evidence, officer, and hand the officer a DVD. And the officer will be only too happy to take that and check that off the list of things to do for the day. The reality is when we ask or expect or rely upon a store owner or a store clerk to download that video, it's almost always done incorrectly through no fault of the employee. But they're further compressing that video when they download it. So when I teach forensic video analysis law now, one of the questions I have for the students is, who is the best person to extract or export video from a server or a hard drive or a DVR? And the answer to that question is someone who knows what they're doing. And that may be the store clerk, it may be a police officer, or it may be a forensic video technician. So one of the issues with acquiring video is acquiring it correctly and acquiring all of it.
Excellent. So what are some of the challenges with then? So like you say, I think we just assume that we just go, they hand us a DVD and away we go. But to find somebody that understands the critical issues and extract it appropriately, what are some of the keys or the problems if we fail to do that properly?
Well, we have an obligation as, I'll speak for the prosecution, we have an obligation as the prosecution to tender evidence that fully covers the event in question. And so where we run into trouble is, even assuming that we acquire the video correctly in the sense that it's not further compressed, if we don't get all of the video, then we create a situation where the defendant is able to say, well, I appreciate that in cameras 1, 3, and 6, it shows what the prosecution believes happened, but if they had acquired the video from cameras 4 and 5, they would see that I was actually acting in self-defense because of things that happened in a different camera angle off-camera for the ones that were acquired. So it creates a disclosure problem where we're using evidence, but we're not necessarily disclosing all of it because we don't have all of it. So that creates an admissibility problem and ultimately a proof problem when we can't produce all of the evidence that's required. And there have been cases in Canada and the United States where that has been the result because the court has said we cannot rely on this video because it does not tell the whole story.
Excellent. So I'm assuming then there's a couple of issues. So one that you talked about was getting all the relevant camera video and all the relevant time frames, which is one element, as you talked about, that if we only get some of the cameras, not all of them. And then the other element is it's how it's downloaded so that we're not altering the quality or compressing the video. So are those the kind of the keys that we need to be very cognizant of?
Yeah, that is true. We have an obligation. Any party who puts in video evidence has a positive obligation, both statutorily and by virtue of case law, to authenticate that video. And authentication means establishing that the video is what it purports to be. And so that means that if we say to the court, this is video of a particular bank robbery on a particular day at a particular time at a particular location, we have to establish that it really is that. And so acquisition of the video is part of the authentication process. And what prosecutors often fail to appreciate and what investigators often fail to appreciate is that whoever puts in the video has an obligation to establish three things. And so it was always my practice as a prosecutor to make sure at the very beginning of a file that when I realized there was video evidence, I made sure that we could establish these three things. And so first, the party tendering the video has to lead evidence as to how that video was exported from the hard drive or the DVR or the server. And so that means that we need a statement from someone who will say, I exported the video from this device, and here's how I did it. Secondly, we need to lead evidence as to whether the exporting was done correctly. Did they get all the camera views? Did they get all of the relevant times? Did they further compress it when they downloaded it? And then thirdly, we need to lead evidence as to whether the evidence now seen in court has been edited or altered in any way. And that is all part of the authentication process, which begins with the acquisition of video. And there are many examples in North America of video being ruled inadmissible because the prosecutor did not address those three critical issues. And it's very hard to address those issues a year or two after the fact to find the witnesses to give that evidence.
Now, is another issue with if we fail to do this correctly at the time, and then we realize afterwards that we perhaps screwed that up or missed a critical step, I'm assuming that sometimes when you can't go back because sometimes the video isn't evidence isn't there anymore, that it's been wiped out or they haven't stored it. Is that an issue as well, that this the critical nature of doing it right the first time?
It is. A couple of examples. Let's say that we have a file where video was accessed from a commercial establishment and it was the clerk who downloaded the video. That clerk is going to be the one giving us the answer to questions one and two, who exported it and did they do it correctly. If we don't take a detailed statement from that clerk right away, then a year later when the prosecutor is trying to figure out how to authenticate this video, the police go back to the store, and chances are, if the clerk still works there, the clerk's going to say, I don't remember this case because I do this every week. So we have a problem in proof. The other issue that we have is that if it wasn't done correctly to begin with, then you're quite right. We typically can't go back and do it again because most video will be gone probably at the latest 30 days from a commercial establishment because it gets overwritten to record new content. If it's police video, that tends to stick around longer, so we might have an opportunity to get that back. But yes, that is a real challenge, that if we don't do it right to begin with, we may not ever be able to do it.
Now, for agencies, for smaller agencies where they may not have some of this technical expertise, or you know, they're working sometimes in some areas where they have pretty limited access to some of these resources, is there if they haven't had the ability to go for training from someone like yourself on how to do this properly, are there people that they could look to or should be thinking about talking to that would have that expertise to help them to download it properly?
Yeah, there are. There are, you know, for example, LEVA, you mentioned that in the introduction. LEVA trains forensic video technicians across North America, and in every state there would be forensic video technicians. Those are people who are skilled at acquiring video correctly, and so those people can be resources. There are best practice guides on the LEVA website that provide information as to how to acquire video. I think the most important thing is for someone to recognize that I don't know what I'm doing and I need help. And by reaching out in those ways, they can get the video in an appropriate and scientifically sound way. Where they fall into error is just happily accepting the DVD or CD from the store clerk and assuming it's been done correctly, only to perhaps find out at trial a year or two later that it wasn't.
Now, are you seeing video that more places. So, you know, I guess the standard would be that there's a store or the a bank or the location of the offense, and there's video cameras in there that are recording that. But what about other security cameras or traffic cameras or other things that may be recording critical movements or activity in the area? Are you seeing now a broader and broader where there's more and more videos that are out there that are capturing a lot of these other activities that that come into play?
Absolutely. In my experience prosecuting major crimes, rarely do I have video of the actual event going down. Typically, the video that I have in my case is video from a someone's security camera at the back of their house or in their front driveway that captures a vehicle or a person going by at a particular time of interest. It may be someone's personal dash cam video that captures something of interest. It may be a store that has nothing to do with this case but happens to capture a vehicle outside or a person outside. And so these are the video sources that the police go to gather video that is often remarkably helpful. A homicide I prosecuted recently had critical evidence from a cab that just happened to be sitting in a parking lot where a murder occurred, and the cab video didn't capture the murder but captured the sound of the gunshots and captured the gunman running in the direction of the cab. So we really have to expand our ambit when we're looking for video and not just look in the store, but look for other sources.
Excellent. And in today's world, I'm assuming that social media videos that are captured on people's phones and all of those other elements are a big issue as well. What would be some of the challenges with using those social media videos?
The big challenge with social media video is authentication. And that is a tremendous source of potentially valuable evidence because these days, so many people are recording video and capturing really critical events, but then they upload them anonymously to a social media website. And where people fall into error in the criminal justice system is they assume that because we've got this video, we can use it. And that is the problem with social media video, is we cannot use that video unless we can authenticate it. We've got cases in both Canada and the United States where this has been litigated, and with actually no exceptions of the cases I've read, all of that social media video has been ruled inadmissible for want of authentication. Because what we're missing typically with social media video is we don't know who the videographer is, so we don't have the person to come to court to say, I shot this video and it fairly and accurately depicts the event. And we don't have someone at the event who can authenticate that video. And in fact, even in one case from the United States where they did have someone present who could theoretically authenticate the video, the court did not allow that video in because there was, in fact, a several-second gap in the video that this witness could not account for. So we've had cases where the prosecution and the defense have tried to use social media video to their advantage only to have it ruled inadmissible because the court was not satisfied that it was authentic. So we have a long ways to go before we can use social media video in an actual case.
What would be some of the keys then? So if there's critical video captured from a social media source that investigators become aware of, what would be some critical steps for them to take in an attempt to authenticate the video?
So the best thing to do is to try and determine who actually shot the video. Now, sometimes it's the actual defendant who shot the video. There have certainly been examples of that where in the United States, defendants have stolen cars and beaten up people and then videotaped themselves in the stolen car and posted that to their own website. So that's not very bright. We don't usually have that benefit. But typically, what we want to do is find the person who shot the video, failing which, someone who was there at that event who can vouch for the integrity of the video. And that's very difficult. The challenge with social media video is that many times when it's uploaded to YouTube, for example, it's stripped of all its metadata so that a forensic video analyst analyzing that video can't tell much about the integrity of that video because all of the metadata that is needed to make that assessment has been stripped. We saw that in a case in Ontario a couple of years ago where a police officer was being prosecuted for an allegation of assault causing bodily harm arising out of the G20. And the prosecution was using social media video as evidence against the officer, but both the prosecution expert and the defense expert stated that they could not vouch for the authenticity of the video because of the stripping of the metadata when it was uploaded to YouTube. So you have valuable evidence that is probably quite accurate, but it can't go in because probably quite accurate doesn't meet the legal test.
So what would be some of that metadata information then that would be stripped away that would be so critical in this as a piece of evidence?
So you would lose important things like date, time, geographical coordinates for where the video was shot. You would lose information about frame rate, about compression, all of the things that you need to properly evaluate that video evidence. And so you end up with video that appears to be accurate, but you just don't know that it is because you don't have the tools that you need to point out, yes, based on this interface, I can tell that this video was recording correctly. I can tell that it was recording at the correct frame rate, etc.
Now, if they're able to track down the source, the person who took the video, do they need to then somehow seize that device or download it from their phone or something to get the original video in addition to having this person that you would subpoena to testify?
Yes, that would be ideal. The original recording on the original device would allow us to authenticate that video. For example, the Calgary Police Service announced last year a new project in the traffic section, and that is that people could upload video footage from their own personal cell phones, typically from traffic cams or dash cams. They could upload that video to the Calgary Police Service website, and the Calgary Police Service certainly did this correctly, is they said when you upload that video, it cannot be anonymous. You have to tell us who shot the video. You have to provide a full statement to the police, and we want you to preserve the original video. So in that way, when someone reports that they have video of an interesting event, the police have the ability to go and properly acquire that original video so that we don't have authentication concerns. It's the anonymous posting that is the danger zone.
Right. Now, is there a requirement for a search warrant to obtain that original video from the source if we know who it is? And so somebody was to upload that, for example, to the Calgary Police site, and it was of critical nature in an investigation. Do they need to, when they go and attempt to get the original, is that a requirement that they have a search warrant for that?
Unless they're requiring video from the defendant himself or herself, so long as they have consent from the holder of the video, then they would not require a warrant. But if that person, for example, is not willing to provide it to the police, but the police have reasonable grounds to believe the video is in their home on their phone or on their camera, then you would need a warrant for that because it is evidence in support of an offense.
Excellent. So you've talked about some critical issues, acquiring video, authenticating video, some of the challenges with social media video. What about editing video before we enter it into court? Is there some critical elements around that piece?
Yeah, there are. There's a misconception that editing video is bad. The reality is we edit almost all video when we enter it into court, but we do it for legitimate reasons. So, for example, if a bank robbery occurs at noontime and the police go to the bank and they get the video, they might get 5 or 6 hours of video. We're not going to show 5 or 6 hours of video to a jury when we're actually only interested in the 4 or 5 minutes that a bank robbery occurs. So we will acquire all of that video, disclose all of that banking video to the defense, but ultimately only use 4 or 5 minutes. Another example, I've had many cases where I've tendered evidence before the court of a statement made by the defendant, but the statement is made over a period of 16 or 20 hours in police custody. Someone may be arrested at midnight, and they're allowed to sleep in an interview room for 8 hours, but we have the video rolling. Unless they say something or do something important, we're not going to show that to the jury. We'll tell them that video exists, but we don't actually show that. When the police leave the room in the course of an interview, if nothing occurs during that period of time, we'll put in a title slide indicating that video has been removed. So when I have led evidence of a defendant giving a statement to the police, what the jury sees might be 2 hours, even though the person was in police custody and being video recorded for 20 hours. So editing is entirely proper so long as it is done correctly and it's done for a legitimate purpose. Where we get into trouble is where the editing is done for an improper purpose, so that what we're seeing in the end ends up being unreal. That isn't really what happened. They've changed the chronology of the events. They've left out key data, that sort of thing.
Excellent. Now, from an editing perspective, in today's world with all the privacy issues, is there issues with other people that were captured in the video that may have nothing to do with this particular case? Is there any issues around that piece?
You know, there could be, and I think it would depend where the video was taken from. If the video is perhaps in a public place that shows a bunch of children or something like that, what may happen in court is that that video may be redacted in the sense that those other faces may be blurred out. So we can protect legitimate privacy concerns that way by doing the appropriate blurring of the video. In my experience, I haven't had to do that, because the fact that other people happened to be in the video just didn't raise any concern for anyone. But that could be an issue.
Excellent. And so then I'm assuming that the video is edited from an authentication standpoint, there's a need to have whoever did the editing. Is that an issue where the person that did the editing, that you need to have them at least available for court to say, yes, I got this video in this format and this is what I did to edit it?
Yes, that's right. What I would do is I would give specific instructions to whoever's doing the editing, telling them this is what I want in, this is what I want taken out, this is what I want the title slides to say in between each edit. I disclose that to the defense, and then I ask them if they take any issues with the editing. I've never had anyone take issues with the editing, so I've never had to call anyone on the editing, but I always have that person at least notionally available should the editing itself become an issue.
So it would be prudent, I'm assuming, for the investigators to have all of the video and then have the editing done in consultation or under the direction of the prosecutor?
Yes. Yeah. It's the prosecutor that has to run with that evidence. So the prosecutor has to be happy with what is being presented. And so that is very much something you would do in concert with whoever is going to be leading the evidence, whether it's the prosecutor or defense counsel, whatever side is putting in the video.
Now, what came to mind as we were talking that we didn't talk about with acquiring and authenticating video is the issue of when the video is ours. So it's the video from a body-worn camera, video from in-car video camera. Is there keys when we're using our own video that sometimes we perhaps don't save it or capture it or download it appropriately? Is it the same kind of issues as when we get a video from a security camera in a store?
Yeah, they're exactly the same issue. There's a super added issue, though, when it's police video, and that is the perception that when there isn't video of something that should have been recorded, or when there's only partial video of an event, then we have that additional concern that the police have deliberately either failed to record or destroyed evidence that would place the police in a bad light. That typically isn't the same concern for all other types of video. But the police have to follow the same rules. They have to authenticate that video. They have to download all of the appropriate cameras. They have to produce all of the relevant video, because in the end, it's not the police that will decide what video is relevant. It is the counsel and the court who will decide what is relevant. And I've certainly seen cases where the police have been heavily criticized for turning their cameras off at an inopportune or opportune time, depending on your perspective, or for really intentionally failing to record something that should have been recorded.
Excellent. So it would be the same issues as we want all of the cameras. So any of the vehicles, any of the officers that were there within the time frames, we need to gather that from all of those sources rather than just perhaps, say, the involved officer. There might be numerous officers there, so we might be going through a lot of footage from multiple sources, correct?
Yeah, very much so, because we tend to think that the police car or the body cam that shows the main event is the key video evidence. But sometimes other video captures events before or after, or it captures audio that isn't on the main video. And forensic video analysts have the ability to create a timeline using all of the video that's been captured to properly show an event. So they can show video from one car camera, then transition to another car camera to get the full event. And so the more video we have, the more we can get from that event. Sometimes a police officer will say, that's not the way it happened, and yet the video seems to show that it was. Oftentimes other video angles, other audio, will provide a different perspective that may in the end vindicate that officer's perception that the video isn't accurate. Not that it's not authentic, but it doesn't show the whole event.
Excellent. And I guess there's a case that comes to mind that I, you know, Force Science Institute used to reference, where when you watch this officer-involved shooting from one video camera, it would appear that the officers may have just murdered this individual in a parking lot. Yet when you watch the second video from a different camera, as you say, it changes the dynamics of this. Now you get the complete picture. Without that second camera, if somebody would have failed to capture that or they wouldn't have had a camera, it certainly would have impacted the case. Is there anything else that we need to be very cognizant of when it's law enforcement video, that it's body-worn cameras or in-car video cameras or perhaps cameras from our holding cell area or from our interview rooms?
I think the only thing we have to be cognizant of is the need to preserve all of that video so that interested parties can make adequate use of that. And I think sometimes there's a perception among some officers that the less video, the better. But the reality is, oftentimes video evidence will come to the assistance of an officer and will ultimately vindicate that officer's actions if we're looking at a use of force type example. I've always been a proponent for my entire prosecution career that I would rather have all of the evidence and assess it and learn the truth of a case rather than have just part of the evidence and try and guess at what the truth is.
Excellent. A great point. Now, once we have acquired the video, we've gone through the proper steps to make sure that we can authenticate it, and we understand the editing is going to be at the direction of whoever is leading the evidence. I'm assuming that there's huge issues or potentially huge issues around properly interpreting video evidence, that because of some of the things that you've talked about, compression, frame rate, aspect ratio, that we may not be seeing what we think we're seeing, or we may misinterpret what's on the video. Can you speak to that critical piece?
Yeah, and you know, that's a good segue you've done there, because right, once we've got the video, we still have to do something with it. Once it's authentic, once we've got all the relevant video, we have to properly use that video. And so some examples, aspect ratio, that is the height to weight ratio of an image. I've seen many Bolo images out there that will show that the police are looking for a short, squat bank robber driving a clown car, but in reality, they're looking for a tall, thin bank robber driving an SUV. But the images that they're putting out to the public are completely wrong, because the person who's done that work doesn't have any clue about aspect ratio, and so they're putting out photos in ridiculous aspect ratios. So if no one catches that, we end up being in court, and we're showing video of the bank robbery, and the jury can see this short, squat bank robber holding up the place. All the defense lawyer has to do is say to his client, stand up, please. The client is tall and thin. That's the end of the case. And yet it may well be him in the video. So aspect ratio, interestingly enough, is something that is routinely incorrect. It is routinely the case that people don't address that. If you have someone who knows what they're doing, a trained video analyst or video technician, they'll get that part right. But the untrained eye is the problem. And part of the problem is, with many police agencies, you will have a police officer or a civilian who will think that they know everything there is to know about video, and they will do the video work themselves, not realizing what they don't know and not realizing that what they're doing actually makes the video much more problematic than it needs to be. And I've seen countless examples of that. So aspect ratio is one thing. Compression is another. The main casualty of compression is detail. The more that a video is compressed, in particular digital video, the more we lose. The more we lose for detail. And if we're interested in video for the purpose of seeing a face, seeing a license number, seeing a detail, then the loss of that detail is important. And part of compression is also knowing how to interpret what you have left. I've seen cases at the training stage, thankfully, where an analyst will say, and here we see in the defendant's hand an object that appears to be a gun. But once you know what you're doing, and you're able to cycle through the video appropriately, you realize that there was nothing in that person's gun, and that it's simply a compression artifact, and that artifact doesn't track when you move forward and you move backward, and you realize that it's a defect in the video as opposed to an actual object. We see video of vehicles on someone's garage camera. They capture a vehicle going by in the middle of the night, and the vehicle actually on the video splits in two, becomes two different vehicles, and then at the end of the video in the camera view, joins back up again. Now, of course, that didn't really happen, but that's what you see on video. And so compression can create significant challenges for the viewer of video evidence. And I think frame rate is another area as well that most people fundamentally misunderstand, including police officers who are interpreting video evidence. The typical frame rate, the correct frame rate, is 30 frames per second. That will give us a continuous motion, and from that we can determine that what is shown on the video is what happened. When you reduce that frame rate, you get a completely different perception of that event. So, for example, if we have video that takes one image every 2 seconds, all we know for sure is what happened in that exact millisecond that that image was captured. We don't know anything that happened in between. And we've got some really egregious cases where the police have improperly made assumptions based on that video evidence, not understanding how important frame rate is. One example of that is the Miro case in Florida, where a couple had a nanny, and they thought that their nanny was abusing their child. So rather than getting a new nanny, which makes perfect sense to me, they decided to get a bunch of cameras, a bunch of nanny cameras, and they would hopefully catch the nanny abusing their baby. So every day they would come home with excitement like it was Christmas time, and they would watch the video in the hopes they would catch their nanny abusing their baby. One day they came home and they thought they struck gold. They thought they had video that showed that. They called the police, and the police said, yep, looks like child abuse to me. So the nanny was arrested, charged with 8 felony counts of child abuse, and held in custody pending trial for 2.5 years. 2.5 years later, as the trial date is approaching, someone thought, maybe we should have this video analyzed. And when it went to a competent forensic video analyst, the competent forensic video analyst pointed out the frame rate problems. It was a variable frame rate. And when you look at the video without knowing what you're doing, you see evidence of child abuse. Once you factor in frame rate and how that impacts your ability to interpret those events, there was a completely different interpretation, one that was entirely innocent, because there was actually no evidence the child had been abused. The parents shopped the baby around to many doctors. Every doctor said there's no evidence of child abuse, but they weren't happy. They wanted nanny to pay for something that, as it turned out, the nanny never did. So 2.5 years later, the state said, we're really sorry about that nanny, and they let her go and discontinued the proceedings against her. That's an egregious example. But frame rate is a really critical issue in the interpretation of video evidence.
Excellent, and a great explanation. And it's, I had no idea of any of these issues until a few years ago when I was looking at a case that was an internal investigation against an officer. And one of the key pieces from the departmental prosecution of this officer was video from the cell block area. And you looked at it and you thought you were seeing one thing, but then when the video expert came in and broke it down, all of these issues became a factor as far as there's chunks of time missing. In some cases, there were 1.5 seconds missing in the video. Things appeared to be far faster than they were. And, I mean, the video was of exceptionally limited, if any, value to anybody. So it's so critical that people understand all of these issues. Now, I'm assuming, now, you had written a blog post about video and speed determination from video, and I'm assuming that some of these issues apply. Can you talk about that? Because it seems, and you mentioned previously that it's becoming more and more common that police are being asked to determine speed or attempting to determine speed from video. Can you talk about the critical elements of that?
I will, Brian. I just want to comment on the use of force comment you made before. And you're absolutely right. I have seen a number of cases where, in use of force cases, the video is very damning. And the video makes it look like the officer really has abused a prisoner. But when you take into account frame rate, those jerky motions, those fast motions that you see in reduced frame rate, take on a totally different meaning and place the officer in a much more favorable light. Now, to be clear, if the video shows clear evidence of abuse, then so be it. The truth is the truth. But in relation to speed determination, I would call this a flavor of the month method of determining speed. And the way it works is this. Oftentimes, the police will be able to determine the speed of motor vehicles involved in collisions by using a collision reconstruction expert, or in some cases an engineer. And they'll be able to examine a scene, and by measuring tire marks at the scene, looking at vehicle dynamics, can give minimum speeds at impact. And I've led that evidence probably hundreds of times. in my career. In other cases, or in the same cases, they will also be able to download the CDR from the vehicle, and they'll be able to get computer speeds showing very helpful information, and I've done that many, many times. Another potential method of determining speed is from video evidence, and this is almost always done incorrectly. And here's the usual way that this happens. A police officer, not necessarily an expert in anything, a police officer will get video from some sort of commercial establishment that will show the vehicle in question driving by their premises. And there may be 2 seconds of video. The police officer will look at that video, will measure the distance from the left side of the field of view to the right side of the field of view, and from that will determine the speed of the vehicle. But their determination will always be wrong. We have cases where collision reconstruction experts will do the same. They will have video. They will determine the speed from left to right and will apply simple speed equals distance over time formula and come up with an answer. That too will always be wrong. And that's because the people that are doing that, through no fault of their own, don't have any video expertise. That is the type of thing that you actually need 2 experts. You need a collision reconstruction expert, and you need a forensic video analyst or a forensic video technician, because both people bring different areas of expertise to the same mathematical problem. The untrained eye doesn't understand that when they're determining speed from video, they have to determine what the key or index frames are. Oftentimes, they're taking measurements from a positioning of the vehicle that isn't real. It's a predictive image because of compression. So the computer simply predicts where that vehicle is going to be and puts it there. It isn't an actual key or index frame. Someone with video knowledge would know which frames are index frames and therefore which frames are reliable. They also have to factor into account frame rate and how that impacts their ability to determine speed. There was an interesting case from last year in Ontario, I believe it was last year, where the police were trying to determine speed in a dangerous driving causing death case from video, and they did consult a video expert, and the video expert actually said the frame rate is X and this is not a reliable method in this case of determining speed, and I can't help you any further. The reconstruction expert went on to take that information, figure out the speed himself, and in cross-examination, defense counsel was able to show that there was a 40 or 50 kilometer per hour range of speed once you took into account all of these variables, and that's because the collision reconstruction expert should not have been calculating speed from video. So we have cases in Canada and the United States where people attempt to determine speed from video. And to be clear, it actually can be done, but it requires considerable expertise, it requires training, and it requires the appropriate experts, plural, doing that work.
Excellent. Great information. Now, something that just came to mind as we were talking, The new phones, there's these super high quality videos capability within the new phones that are out there, and they just keep improving the video capability. But is there an issue where the technology is designed to capture the best video possible, so it may erase or override anything that might be an anomaly that might distort that? So you've got this beautiful video at night, but it may override or eliminate, say, muzzle flashes because it's going to now wreck the quality of the video. Is something like that an issue?
That I can't speak to because I'm not a technical expert. Other people could answer that question, but I would be guessing.
Is there the other thing? I guess that just came to mind when I was speaking about that at night. I'm assuming that there's potential issues with video at night, especially if it's a very clear video with the, where the camera has, you know, the ability to record high definition in low light conditions, which is different from the human experience. Is that something that you've run across?
Yeah, and that goes into the reliability of the video. So the video did record something, but is that video reliable? And so we look at things like lighting conditions, we look at the quality of the camera, we look at whether it's black and white, we look at whether it's infrared video, because some cameras will automatically switch to an IR recording in the appropriate lighting conditions, and then we have to interpret the IR video correctly. Examples being, you might have a video showing the actual crime being committed, and it shows a person wearing clothing that appears to be a particular color, and yet the actual person who committed it looks completely different, but he really is the person that did it. But the infrared camera has recorded the clothing in a completely different way, so that it's sometimes the complete opposite color, or the intense pattern on the shirt shows up as a solid color in the IR video. So yes, the camera itself can have an impact on what we ultimately get, and that becomes a reliability issue, further illustrating the need for expert interpretation.
Excellent. Great explanation. Now, I guess one of the challenges from a video perspective is that in real life, say it's an officer-involved incident, and maybe the video is entered in regards to what the officer's actions were. It played out very quickly in real life, but in a courtroom, we have the ability to stop the video, freeze frame the video, highlight certain things. Do you see issues with comparing, say, the officer's memory or their statements or their evidence when it gets compared to the video, when there may be discrepancies, or when somebody's stopping or freezing it and saying, okay, so what were you thinking at this second in time in a very rapidly unfolding event?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. Sometimes there's a real cognitive dissonance between what the officer said happened and what the video showed. One thing that should not happen is that when an officer is asked to write a statement about a use of force incident, that they be allowed to watch the video first before they write their statement. Because what sometimes happens is an officer says, well, I don't remember it happening that way, but it's on video, so I guess I better write it that way. And they end up adopting what's in the video only to realize later that the video, for all the various reasons we've been talking about today, isn't accurate. So yes, there are absolutely challenges, because an officer isn't going to remember everything that happened in an event, and we look to that video evidence to supplement it. Of course, opposing counsel would look to that video evidence to contradict what the officer has to say. But I've always been of the view, for over 30 years as being a prosecutor, it has never been my job once to get a conviction. Never was I told that my job was to get a conviction, because my job has always been to find the truth, and the truth will take us wherever it takes us. And so the fact that there's a discrepancy between what an officer says in a use of force incident or any other incident involving the officer, a discrepancy between that and the video isn't the end of the world, so long as we can find a way, if it exists, that one can accentuate the other. And yes, in court, we do have the luxury of being able to show that video second by second and grill the officer as to what happened here. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? And that places the officer in a very difficult position, because life doesn't happen at that speed. Life happens much quicker. And so video can be very helpful to an officer, But it can also be very challenging to an officer trying to defend their conduct for the very reason that you've suggested.
Excellent. Now, just to go back, you mentioned that your preference is to have the officer write their initial statement without looking at the video. What are your thoughts on the officer writing their initial statement and then subsequently watching a video in the event that the video may trigger some memory, not with the mind of, hey, I don't remember that happened, so I guess it did, but is there value in them watching it at some point in that process, or would you prefer not?
No, I think there is value in the officer watching the video so long as it's not something that they do before they write any statements, because that does a disservice to the officer. Because really what you're doing is you're getting two witnesses to collaborate on a statement. The video camera is a witness, the officer is another witness, and they're getting together on their story. That's how it appears. And so you want an independent statement from the officer, you have the independent statement from the camera, and then later on the officer can comment on the video evidence. And you're right, that may spark further memory, or it may require them or cause them to explain something.
Excellent. So a ton of great information, Jonathan, and I really appreciate it. Now, what's the best way for people to find out more about the services that you offer? Because you offer some great training on a multitude of levels. What's the best way for people to find out more about what you do and the services that you offer and look at taking some of the training that you do offer?
Yeah, I think what I would do is go to my website, www.jonathanhack.com, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N-H-A-K.com. And what people will find there are three things. First, a tremendous amount of information on forensic video analysis issues and law, and a considerable amount of information on expert witness testimony issues. And then they will also find their upcoming courses that I'm teaching on expert witness testimony or courtroom testimony for investigators in various countries. And those course offerings will expand as the number of courses that that I offer expand.
Excellent. And if an agency was interested in hosting some of that training and running one of those programs in their area, is that an option that you offer?
Yep, they can simply contact me. Most of the time when I do training, it's under that basis, that an agency wants to put the course on, retains me to teach the course, and then they go about filling the spots in the course. So the actual cost to the hosting agency is relatively small because they distribute that cost among other agencies.
Excellent. Terrific. And I would encourage people to go to Jonathan's website and have a look around, subscribe to his blog, because there's some great information that comes out on that, on some of these critical issues, and stay in touch with that. So, Jonathan, I want to thank you for your time. You've got a crazy busy schedule and you're traveling all over the world teaching, and I appreciate you making time once again. But more importantly, I want to thank you for your service, for your 30-year service as a Crown Prosecutor, for all of the teaching that you've done over the years and continue to do, and everything that you have done and continue to do to contribute to our knowledge, our understanding, our expertise, and to raise the bar for our profession. I truly want to thank you for that and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure to be of assistance.
And so for the members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, as always, I would encourage you to let the information that Jonathan shared, he shared a lot of great information, let the information simmer or percolate overnight, and then be intentional tomorrow. Sit down and write out your greatest takeaways. Write out some action steps. What actions do you need to take to either implement or to share this information so that we're addressing this critical piece that is just becoming more and more and more prevalent for us in our world and our investigations? And so for the members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, as always, thank you for your commitment to excellence both in and through training. Always continue to train hard, train smart, train with passion and purpose, and always be willing to dare to be great.